Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from AltaSpeed Technologies, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and pick your questions on how to do the same. The phone lines are open to be a part of the program. It's a free call, 1-855-450-NOAH. It's 1-855-450-6624 or send an email to live at asknoahshow.com. My name's Noah Chalaya. I am your host. Delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah show kicks off this hour. Joining me, my co-host, Mr. Steve Evans. Welcome in, sir.
Good evening, Noah. How are you?
You know, I'm happy to be back in the studio. I'll be honest with you. The beach had its appeal, but I dropped my laptop in the sand, and so there was sand all over my laptop. And then the thing that I didn't really anticipate, I get back to the hotel, and I get most of the sand out of the USB and HDMI port. And then I find that, like, all of the little metal iron fragments that are in the beach got attracted via magnet to the little magnet that detects when the lid is closed. And it was a disaster to try and clean that out. So I think that's the place for me. They don't take me outside very much. And I like it that way.
I mean, we're frozen over down here. So, I mean, you went to the beach and we froze over.
Yeah, I get frozen. It keeps the riffraff out. You ready to get into some feedback?
Sure.
Our first email comes in from Joe. Joe writes in and says, "Hi, guys. A couple of weeks ago, I sent in an email recommending PHP as an alternative to Django. I think the response took a suggestion a bit as a challenge, and I just wanted to clarify, I didn't intend it as such. I merely wanted to suggest an alternative that I happened to find a bit more accessible to my brain. Second, the Kanban tool in Nextcloud is deck, not tasks. Just search for deck in the app store they have. Third, again, just an alternative. I also have a project around displaying and creating handling notes or posts similar to sticky notes. It does commenting, user, sharing, and groups, as well as some rudimentary task creation. Any links to the GitHub page? Again, just an alternative I thought I'd share. Cheers, Joe." First thing is, Joe, we really appreciate you writing in. And even if we present it as a bit of a challenge, we try to challenge ourselves, right? If something comes up and comes to top of mind to you and you say, "Hey, have you considered this?" We want to ask that question. We want to think about it thoroughly. So we appreciate you bringing it up, and it wasn't meant hostile in any way. What's funny about your deck comment, literally we didn't get off the air, and we were having our post-show wrap-up, and as soon as we opened the mumble room back up, everybody's going, "You meant to say deck," and yes, we absolutely did. And so I stand by everything I said. If you've used Trello and you've used deck, I don't think it's a one-to-one replacement. I think if all you need is task management and you're dragging it from one place to the other, I think deck absolutely accomplishes that. But I don't think it's a one-to-one replacement for something like Trello. I don't know, Steve, even knowing the proper add-on, is it something you consider? Are you still pretty happy with your Kanban solution?
No, I think I'm pretty good where I am right now. I might take a peek at it later, but ultimately I think I would want to stay separate. Like, Nextcloud is largely a personal thing, whereas the purpose of the Kanban board is to kind of keep myself organized for work. And so I'll probably try and keep those separate.
Our second email comes in from Alexander. Alexander says, "Please kindly stop asking what problem does Nix solve. Nix does not solve any problems. It just skips the part when one creates them. Just like Linux users laugh at Windows users that need to reinstall to get a system into a usable state, Nixers laugh at other Linux users that need to reinstall a system to get it into a known state. Just like Linux needs sysadmins to relearn Nix, Nix requires Linux users to unlearn their self-destructive habits. Nix is just Linux." Alexander. So, I don't know, Steve, what do you think here?
I have a lot of thoughts about this. So first of all, I probably am not going to stop asking what problems does this solve, because just as a societal outlook, we as humans rank order what we are going to do and where we're going to spend our attention because we have to. We can't focus on everything. And as a part of that, we inherently ask, what problem is this solving, or what does this do for me? And that's how we decide largely where we're going to spend our time. And so the question of what problem does this solve is not pointed specifically at Nix or NixOS, but it's a framework that if you go back and listen to the back catalog, I have a long history of asking this question. And I know Noah shares similar opinions for other types of things. It's like, well, when you're evaluating where are you going to decide to invest time, like I study languages, I work out, I have kids, I have dog, I have a full-time job. Something has to give if I'm going to take on something new like this. And so it's a legitimate question to say, well, what problem is this actually solving for me? Like, why should I take time out of my life to learn to do this thing that is esoteric to begin with? And you could say, oh, well, Linux, you know, the Linux operating system is the same sort of thing, except my counter to that was I got applicable life job skills, which got me my career by using alternate, like open source software. And at this point in time, I don't see the same thing for Nix. And now maybe in 10 years time, or NixOS, I should say, maybe in 10 years time, I'll eat my hat. But for right now, I have to prioritize things based on when I think the hurdle is worth overcoming. I look at it and say, well, what's on the other side? If it's not worth it, you know, or if I don't perceive it to be worth it. That's the other thing. And I'm not trying to be denigrating. If you want to go and learn Nix, that's cool. I spent time and sat down and learned Arch, and people will probably say the same thing about that. And maybe in some time, they're in some way, they are kind of similar, Arch and Nix, in terms of like, hey, it took you an effort to go learn how to do this thing, and you just have to get over that hump. And maybe that's the same thing. But for now, I'm still going to use that what problem does this solve kind of framework as I approach any kind of new technology.
So first of all, the chat room demands a picture if you eat your hat. So if that happens, please take pictures. But secondly, can you talk a little bit about, so if we think about it from an evangelistic standpoint, okay, so you're going in to share something of a new skill or a new piece of technology that you've learned, and you just think it's the best thing since sliced bread. And so you're trying to tell somebody about that thing. What's the most, I'm going to ask it this way, what is the most effective way to do that?
So one of the things that I have observed being in the corporate world is that you can convince somebody to use your thing, but if you haven't determined what it helps them with or identifies a problem that it solves, it's not going to be sticky. And what I mean by that is you turn around and they run into a problem and they're just going to likely throw it out because they don't want to invest the time trying to figure out how to fix it for themselves. So if you want continued adoption, you know, one of the things that Red Hat likes to do is we like to say, hey, try our software and we'll come in side by side with you and teach it to you and your company for, you know, X number of weeks so that you actually can see what it does. So we work with them and we make a proof of concept project for them so that they have a goal where they start with nothing and then we get to something and they can see how that benefits them. And it's the same thing with Nix. It's like, you can't just say, well, this is the best and this is why I think it's the best. That's fine, right? First of all, that's cool. But if you're trying to, evangelize and get people to come over to your side, just like the problem that we have had with Linux in the past is just telling people like, hey, it's Linux and it does some stuff and it's awesome, you should try it. You'll get a few people, you will, and you'll get some very happy people, but you're not going to get a level of adoption because in order for people to really grab onto something, they want to make it theirs. And the way that you normally accomplish that is by them finding something that they think is really neat about this thing and they latch onto it.
Tiny had a really good quote. We were talking about, not this specifically, but we were talking about similar concepts a few weeks ago. And Tiny said, and he was citing a quote, given sufficient why, man will accomplish any amount of how. And I really like that, right? If you can give somebody a good enough reason to do something, they're willing to jump through almost any amounts of hoops. But I think in order to make it, as you would say, Steve, to make it sticky, you have to make it sticky for to and to be sticky, it has to solve a problem for somebody.
Yep. And ultimately, they might not even think it's as a problem, but usually it is. People, especially when it comes to technology, even technologists fight inertia. Like, it's working. I kind of prodded along, and maybe it takes me more effort than it should, but it takes me a whole lot more effort to tear it down and do something new. And so I'm more likely to just kind of prod along the thing that is less good because it takes me less effort. And that's just the way humans are. Is you have to beat the inertia factor somehow.
So I wanted to try to understand where Alexander was coming from. So I get what he's saying when he says it doesn't solve a problem. It just skips the part of the problem and then skips right to a solution and then tries to kind of backpedal into the problem. I understand where he's coming from. At the same time, I don't know that I find it helpful to say we shouldn't ask questions, right? I don't think there's any such thing as a stupid question. I think there's just ineffective teaching methods. That is to say, if a question comes up, it might be because something hasn't otherwise been easily enough explained. And so I don't have any interest in being willfully ignorant. I don't have any interest in being like the ostrich who sticks his head in the sand. I agree with Alexander to a point that I wouldn't go around installing this on metal, in part because I still have questions by way of when the next guy comes in and says, how was all of this orchestrated? How was all of this engineered? How was all of this architected? That's going to be a difficult question for me to answer today. However, I think if we put our goggles on and kind of look a little bit into the future, helping people get to where they want to go rather than helping them come along to where you want to go can be a helpful way to frame things. And if you look at where people want to go, they want to get away from, they want to obfuscate the technology. They want to get to a point where whatever it is that the end goal, whatever it is they're looking for, is oftentimes not an underlying piece of technology, not a particular distribution, not a particular library. They just have a thing that they want to run. And I think the problem that Nix potentially solves is it allows you to instantaneously access that thing without having to put any sort of effort or thought into the underpinnings that surround that thing. Now, there's other technical ways to solve it. But again, when you start asking people, well, we do that with containers. Okay, well, to do containers, then we have some security concerns. Yeah, but those can be obfuscated with Podman. And pretty soon you get into this very complicated system of a way of doing things. And I think Nix has the potential anyway to simplify that down. And if you think about it, oftentimes the best ideas are simple in nature. And if the ideas aren't simple in nature, it sometimes can be because it just hasn't had enough time to distill down to something elegant. And so I agree with you. I don't think we're there yet. I think we're a ways away from this being something that everybody adopts. But I do think we're approaching the precipice on where you're going to start to see, well, you are seeing companies and organizations popping up with products built by Nix or powered by Nix, and it's leveraging that declarative technology to make something appear and just be available. 1-855-450-NOAA. It's 855-450-6624. The email live at asknoahshow.com. Those are the ways to join the program. We'd love to have you. Tony calls from Toronto, Canada. Welcome in, sir.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question. So I was listening to a podcast. I was catching up on a few of them from maybe 2-3 weeks ago, and you guys were talking about how you guys, I think specifically you, Noah, you deploy with your customers Linux workstations, and then, you know, if they need QuickBooks or whatever, you know, Windows billing software, there's a virtual machine that they remote into to do whatever task they need to, but most stuff they can do on their Linux PC. So I found mm-hmm. the same thing, and I'm looking at potentially at our business moving us over to be, as much as we can, to be Linux on the workstations, right? But I'm struggling to find out how I can manage central authentication. Like right now we're using an Active Directory server. And, you know, if I can, I mean, if there's a way, like, I'm wondering, like, how are you doing? Are you deploying an Active Directory server and then joining those? Is there a way to kind of have an Active Directory less environment? And I kind of want to know what your thoughts were and how you're doing things.
So we'll start with the most ideal solution, and I'll work my way back to what you can do. So, Steve, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the most open source ideal ways to implement central authentication?
So I guess the first question is this still a mixed environment? Are you still having to deal with Windows or Mac as well as Linux desktop?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So that becomes a little more challenging. It's not insurmountable, right? There are projects like Free IPA or Red Hat has an IDP, an IDM server and stuff like that. And then you can install binaries in those various environments like a Windows or a Mac that will allow them to bind to that type of server. Some people think that that's a little bit too much of an ask, right? Because instead of installing something on this oddball Linux, we're installing something on the Windows and the Mac machines that natively already talk to some central authentication. So my other question for you would be, are you looking just for single sign-on? Like, can this person log in to the machine, or are you looking for group policy? Are you looking for some level of control? What are you looking for?
I mean, like what we're doing now, we're not doing any group policies. We're pretty much exclusively using it for just creating logins, really, right? And I mean, there's a few other little things that tie into it with LDAP, so that way it's a single authentication. But really, yeah, not just looking for logins.
So you start with the idea. So Free IPA would be one of my first choices, but you could also, there's a couple of distributions out there that are based on Samba 4, which attempt to emulate an Active Directory server. And those, the Macs and the Windows, can use their native Active Directory binding to those servers. And that can be a good way to go as well. The challenge on that side of things is Linux doesn't natively integrate with Active Directory. There's plenty of guides and packages out there that can help with that. So those would be the two kind of open sourcey ways. Is there something that you had in mind, Noah?
So I'm a huge proponent of Zentol. So Zentol is a Linux alternative to Windows Server. And effectively, it is almost a drop-in replacement for Active Directory. Now, as you pointed out, Steve, it's not always the most straightforward. Okay, so let's back up a little bit. Active Directory is really a mix between Kerberos and LDAP, right? There's a couple different components that are put together. So you can, and it's getting easier, join a Linux box to a Windows domain. So if you primarily have Windows boxes and you're looking for an open source drop-in replacement where you're not spending thousands of dollars a year on licensing for Microsoft, I think Zentol is a great choice. Past that, I would push you towards things like FreeIPA. And Steve, you would know more about this than I would, but FreeIPA is kind of a Linux-first solution, right? Like, even if you didn't have any Windows boxes in the mix, FreeIPA should work really, really well. And even if you do need to add Windows boxes, it's possible to get there. It's just you're bending the arm backwards on the Windows boxes instead of, in the Zentol case, you're bending the arm backwards on Linux boxes.
Right, right. What do you do, Noah, with your mixed environments? Like, when you have those instances where you have mainly all Linux PCs and the one Windows that you're remoting into, are you just creating a local user on that Windows PC?
Yes. So almost all of them, if we can avoid it, we avoid having a domain controller altogether. If we have to put a domain controller in, it's typically going to be Zentol. I don't know. I'm trying to think. I can't think of a time where we sold somebody a Windows license. We've quoted it out a few times because they'll say specifically, hey, we need this version of Windows. But I don't actually remember a time since 2009 that we've actually sold somebody a Windows license, not in any small part due to the fact that if you go and dig through Windows Cal licensing, it's confusing as all get out. And you have to have somebody that knows all the ins and outs of Microsoft to get all of that to work.
Right. I've even entertained the idea of, because we use, to your recommendation, Simple Help.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, like, should I just have like a job that just rotates the administrator passwords, you know, like have a local administrator password for, you know, installing software and whatnot, and then just create local user accounts. But I have a one central administrator password pushed down. Like, is that crazy talk or?
No, that's not crazy. In fact, that's exactly what we do. We have what we call site password. Site password is there's a local administrative login so that we have kind of that God, you know, everything has gone to heck and we need to be able to get into the thing account. And then we create user accounts for, you know, typically, especially when you're doing a virtualized environment where somebody's remoting in, you're only putting one user per VM. The exception to that is, of course, if you have some sort of very special special Snowflake expensive piece of software, then maybe you'll have a couple people log in. But in those cases, we'll use like a utility account. So let's say the piece of software is called ABC Soft, and it costs $2,000 for a license. So we'll have the computer, and the username will be ABC Soft, and then we'll have a random generated passphrase, and then the people that need to use that will create the shortcut in Remina on their workstations to be able to get into it.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So it seems like there is a way to have like an AD-less IT department kind of, or, you know. Okay, good.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking my call, guys.
Yeah, you bet, Tony. If you have anything else, give us a call back, okay?
Thanks, guys.
1-855-450-NOAA. It's 855-450-6624. Email live at asknoahshow.com. Grimer in the interactive mumble room, mumble.minddrip1.com. joins us, if I can get him into the on-air thing. I'll see if I... There we go. Welcome in, sir.
Hey, Noah. How's it going?
Pretty good.
So I'm taking your suggestion, and I'm deploying Volumio at a small business, and at first glance, this thing looks fantastic. The question that I have is, by default, it comes with, default creds, and it comes with a Samba share that is just wide open. Do you lock that down? If not, why don't you? And if you do, what do you do to lock it down?
Mm. So let's back up a minute. I don't know that I've ever used authentication in Volumio. To my recollection, it just... I mean, you put the IP address in and the control interface comes up, right? There isn't a login.
Well, you can SSH into it with default credentials.
Oh, I see. Okay. I haven't locked it down. Now, to be honest with you, and I'm kind of putting myself out there a bit, it's based off of ignorance, not intentionality. I didn't look at it and go, oh, look at that. It has SSH enabled. I should probably shut that down. I just never bothered to look. It hasn't bitten me yet. I emphasize the word yet.
Okay. What about the Samba share? Because my concern is that I don't want just anybody to potentially, you know, find this thing and say, oh, I can drop music here and, you know, put their own stuff out.
Yeah, I would definitely not leave the Samba share open. So the way that we've typically set that up, we don't store the files on the Volumio device. Rather, we add a Samba share from whatever the client's file server is to Volumio. So we'll create like a media directory or a public music directory, something like that. And then we add that Samba share to Volumio. So Volumio is referencing the file server. Now, the advantage there is we can map that media drive on the people who should have it. And we just tell them, drop the files into this drive, and then they will be available to you in Volumio. You got to rescan the library, but it'll make it available to you in the Volumio library. And then for the more complicated setups, for the more complicated clients, we'll actually deploy Home Assistant. And then we'll add those zones to whatever room or whatever area of the building they want. So when they click on a button to say, you know, oftentimes like at a church, it'll be like pre-service music or post-service music or something like that. So they'll click on the button and then it knows, oh, in this zone, set the volume to this level and play this playlist. In this zone, set it to this level and play it, that sort of thing.
Oh, how cool. I never even thought about that as a use case. That sounds awesome. In my case, there is no server on site. They are adamant that they do not want a server in place. And so, honestly, my next consideration is to just put a USB drive.
That's what I would do. And then I would just tell them, hey, plug this thing in, don't put the music you want on it. Especially, you know where that makes a lot of sense, Grimer, is if... Are they going to be updating the music very often? Or is it, hey, here's the 100-some tracks we want to play in the background, let it go and maybe tie it into our phone system, but then hit play and let it do its thing.
It's going to be pretty simple. It's going to be, here's a handful, you know, 100 tracks or whatever. And we just want this thing to play on repeat.
Yep. I would definitely shut Samba off, but I wouldn't even bother with tying it to, if they don't want a server, I'd put it all onto a drive. I would still separate it out from the system. And here's why. Every Raspberry Pi I've ever had eventually dies, if only because SD cards are not in indefinite life, right? And they go a long time. Like I still have a generation one Raspberry Pi that's running in my house and it runs for a long time. But every 5, 6, 7 years, I have to reflash the SD card. And I wouldn't want to have to go figure out, well, where are all the 100 tracks that they paid for? And if it's in a public setting and there's licensing that's involved, then I wouldn't want to deal with all that. So I'd put it onto a separate drive, maybe make a backup of it and have it sitting there. And yeah, that's exactly what I would do.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. 1-855-450. No, it's 855-450-6624. The email, live@asknoahshow.com. The number to join us, you can be a part of the program. Where did we leave off here? Our email comes in from Craig. Craig writes in and says, "Hi guys, I have recently discovered your show and I'm an aspiring open source enthusiast. I would love to set up Nextcloud for two specific use cases. Perhaps I'll discover more once installed. First, I want to get off iCloud for photo backup sync. This includes my family that isn't super tech savvy. Secondly, I want to have a file server backup that will enable me to get rid of Google Drive. I also want to have an offsite backup for the self-hosted Nextcloud instance. Do you have a recommendation of a way of doing that? I'd prefer another self-hosted solution that costs little or nothing. I don't want to use any cloud-hosted solutions. Finally, I'd like to be able to remotely access all of this with an iPhone, MacBook, PC, or Android device. I've looked at TwinGate and Tailscale, varying opinions on each. Thanks. P.S. Gmail's days are numbered for me, besides ProtonMail, which I'm currently using. Do you have any other recommendations? Craig." So, Steve, you have largely walked this path as Craig has. You've done it with Nextcloud. Tell me about that.
So specifically Nextcloud with iOS is a bit challenging because if you are a third-party app developer, they just kill your application every once in a while. And so you can't rely on it to just hang out in the background. What you can do is you can set up, I forget exactly the terminology, it's a shortcut or something like that. And basically every time that my wife plugs her phone in, it launches the Nextcloud app and starts the sync. And that's the only way that we've found it to be reliable because Apple just says, no, if you're not from Apple, you get killed. We expose Nextcloud to the internet because I use it for file sharing. We sync our calendars. But largely it's because I do file sharing with whomever. So for example, my accountant, I don't send things over email, anything that's sensitive. I drop them a link to my Nextcloud and say, here, come pick up the files or whatever. So you can absolutely set this up over something like OpenVPN or Tailscale or anything like that. And that would work just fine. It really depends on what your goal is. If you want to keep it internal and not worry about security and stuff like that, and only have a certain number of people be able to connect to it, then I would go with a VPN solution like Tailscale or something like that. So yeah, that's ultimately the way that we've ended up going with it. I've been using Nextcloud since it was back in the, what was it called before? It was called OwnCloud. I've been using it that long. Since before my oldest son was born. So 12 years, 13 years, something like that. Long time.
So I would tell you that the Nextcloud is probably the most direct one-to-one replacement for what you're talking about. Steve, can you address how you would deal with backing it up if you wanted to back it up to another place? So that, let's just say, for example, his primary Nextcloud instance goes down. What does he do then?
So what we do, Nextcloud just drops files on your server under the data directory and the user that uploads them. And so I have backup scripts that I wrote that just go and grab that and drop that in multiple places. So not only does it live on top of a ZFS data set, it also gets backed up to both cold storage, and then I have running on top of the machine that's running the ZFS pool, it's also being shipped off to Spider Oak. And so they're just files on the disk. And ultimately, if you really care about the Nextcloud metadata, you need to do some backup of your database, whatever type of database you're running in Nextcloud. We don't care about that. We care about the physical files, right? At the end of the day, if I really needed to, all I do is just simply re-import all of the files and let Nextcloud redo the metadata. So that's how we'd handle the backups.
So Nextcloud, again, probably the most direct, straightforward way to solve your problem. The other thing is direct access to the files is appealing, right? Because it's kind of a fail safe solution. If the Nextcloud solution falls over, well, guess what? You're only down to, you just have all your files and then you got to start over, kind of a thing. But at least you're starting over with all of your files. The way that I've chosen to go about doing this is a bit different. So first of all, let me address the image thing. For picture backup, I would highly recommend Image. Now, full disclosure, I'm not personally using Image yet. It's on the short list of things I am looking to roll out. ahead of my instance, though, is to get it set up for my wife, because I am using the tried and true system of I plug the cable into my phone, I pull all the images off, I put them onto my NAS, and it works just fine. I've been doing that way since I bought my first smartphone, the Palm Trio. Actually, even before that, when it was the Handspring Visor plug-in that went into my Handspring Visor Deluxe. And I've been doing it ever since the same way, and I intend to keep doing it for some time to come. But for other family members, to include my wife, who want a drop-in solution like you're talking about, Image was designed by a guy whose wife was using Google Photos, and he wanted a open-source replacement for Google Photos that would match his wife's expectations. So he wanted her to be able to not have to feel like she was being left out. And so it's a passion project to his. And I think I said this last week as well. Passion projects are some of my favorite because they're some of the best done, because it's scratching an itch of the developer himself. And so we've got a guy that works at AltaSpeed who is, I would describe him as a photo enthusiast. He buys his phone based off of the kind of camera it has on it. He was a Google Photos power user. Just, I mean, every function and feature of Google Photos he was into, and he's now switched over to Image and absolutely loves it and has become one of Image's largest advocates. And so that would be top of my list if I was looking for a really good solid photo syncing solution. As far as doing file syncing, there's a couple different ways to do that. Again, if you want the all-in-one, Nextcloud's going to do all this with one solution. So that's probably very appealing. I'm still doing file sync with C-File, and I'll be honest with you, as much as I like Nextcloud, and we haven't recently had any clients come asking for C-File, but we have plenty of clients coming asking for Nextcloud, and so we have dialed in production hosting of Nextcloud, and that part is great. Everything at AltaSpeed is still running on C-File. All my personal stuff is still running on C-File. I really like it. It's brain dead simple to set up. The downside to C-File as opposed to Nextcloud is the server stores all of the data in blocks. And so if you open up the folder where the C-File data is stored, you're just going to see a bunch of garbledygook. You're not going to see your data because it's being stored in block form. Now, that has its advantages and disadvantages. The advantage there is it makes it possible to do some distribution if you have a different file storing backend. But to just get it up and running, it's kind of nice because you can just install the client on your laptop, on your desktop, point it towards a directory. Bob's your uncle. You're syncing files. One other thing that I've seen that I'll throw out there that I haven't heard mentioned, but I think it's worth bringing up. I've seen a couple of people do something like the following. They'll use something like Nextcloud, or they'll use something like C-File, and they'll get all of their data self-hosted and ready to go. Then they will take and encrypt that data and then sync it up to something like Google Drive. So you're still using, I mean, in that case, you are using Google. However, Google doesn't have access to your data. The data is encrypted. And all you're really doing is buying block storage from Google and then storing it there as your kind of, you know, your cloud backup. Arguably, if you're going to give money to somebody, why not give it to someplace like Spider Oak, as Steven suggested, and support a company that wants to support you and do things in an open source and locally encrypted way? But there are ways to leverage AWS and Google Drive if that's something that you're interested in. As far as TwinGate and TailScale, Tiny in the Geek Lab says TwinGate isn't open source and the Linux app is hot garbage. TailScale has been super easy to use. The clients are open source and you can self-host HeadScale if you don't want to use the cloud service. NetBird is also worth a look if you want the cloud service. All three have similar pricing. And so, and I would also add in there that with TailScale in specific, I think you can get started for free with up to 100 devices, which is likely to drastically exceed what you're looking for. So I think it would get you everything you need. As far as alternatives to ProtonMail, there's a few out there that are, so let me start here. If you need encryption or want encryption, if everybody else that you're emailing is also using the same service, then things like ProtonMail and TutNoah and some of the other ones are very much worth it. If you're not going to be doing that, if you're going to be emailing a bunch of people on other services, the encryption kind of loses some of its value. Sure, it's encrypted on your side, but it's unencrypted on everybody else's side. And the trade-off there and kind of the high price to pay is it's no longer directly compatible with mail clients. You're going to have to host some sort of a bridge, and Proton provides this for you. But you're going to have to host some sort of a bridge to use it with a local mail client if you're not using it in the web UI. So If you're looking for alternatives, some of the ones that we like, Fastmail is great. It's incredibly inexpensive. I think it's $3 or something like that per user. Allows you to use your own domain. The other thing that Fastmail allows you to do that I think is really, or can be really advantageous, you can create as many aliases or sending aliases as you like. So with ProtonMail, they're going to limit how many addresses you can send from. With Fastmail, there's no such limitation. So you can have 100. So what I'll do is every single entity gets its own email to email from, and when emails are returned, they're emailed from that entity's email address, thereby never exposing the actual mail address, and thereby at least trying to limit spam a bit. The only fatal flaw I found with that is there are certain places that will add your email to like a mailing list, and then the email comes from, you know, whatever listserv dot blah, 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 and then it goes to undisclosed recipients, which makes filtering and all the rest of it kind of challenging. But those are some things that you could consider, some things that you could look at, and will get you off of the Google sauce. And while Fastmail isn't encrypted, they don't sell any of your information. And so they'll work with the Five Eyes network. You're not going to avoid any, if you have like a state level attack towards you, it's obviously not the right choice. But if you're just looking for an inexpensive way to have a mail server that isn't monetizing your data, can be a really great choice. Anything we missed, Steve?
I think you about covered it.
Ben writes in and says, "Hey, Noah and Steve, longtime listener to the show. Thanks for this great show and the wealth of information that you provide every week. I have two questions. One, what hosting company would you recommend for hosting a business website? WordPress, Udoo, etc. Second of all, did you ever hear of Vivaldi web browser? If so, what are your thoughts on it? I've been using it for Firefox for years and I've had some issues with freezing and getting some laggy sometimes. Also, it doesn't like to play security camera smoothly, whereas Chromium browser tends to. Thanks." So I'll let Steve take the Vivaldi one. I'll take the web browser one, or excuse me, the web hosting one. So we're an IT company. AltaSpeed is an IT company. So we typically provide contract IT services. We're an IT guy for places that don't have an IT guy. And yet, despite never ever advertising this, despite never desiring to get into web hosting, all we did was start switching some of our own internal sites over to Hugo. And what we found was, gosh dang it, is it easy to write markdown files and then upload them into a place and then the Hugo engine rebuilds them into static HTML? And the advantage there over WordPress is huge security savings. Also, the sites are faster and it's approachable for just about anybody. You don't need some fancy complicated web control panel. If you want to use the built-in IDE, something like GitHub or GitLab, you can do that. Otherwise, you can literally give somebody a folder with some text documents and say, hey, place the text you want to show up in your site and upload them right here. And in a few minutes, your website will be live. That has become hugely popular. The other method that we've used with Hugo that seems to resonate well with people, we'll put effectively, think of them like placeholders, like images, and then allow people to swap out the images in the placeholders, thereby changing the content of their site. And it becomes a really approachable way, a really kind of WYSIWYG way, you might even think of it, of a way for people to update their site. And despite never really advertising it, never really talking about it, people have come to us and said, hey, would you do that for us? So I think we have a pretty competitive offering. We charge $13 a month. We'll host your site for you. If you have the capability of writing markdown, that is to say, you can open up a text document and change the content from the template to the content that you want. You don't pay us anything to deploy or to build the site for you. If you want, it's expensive to hire an IT company to write text files for you, but we'll certainly be happy to help you do that if you want. So I'll throw myself out there and say that we'd be happy to do that. If you're interested, send an email to help@altaspeed.com and say, hey, I'm looking to get onboarded to doing website hosting. Otherwise, the thing that I really like about Hugo is you can go to gohugo.io. You can spin yourself up a VM on DigitalOcean or a Linode or an AWS or a Vulture. And in, I would say, no more than 30 minutes, you could have yourself up a functioning website because it's very, very easy to deploy. It's very approachable and it's very easy to make changes. You don't have to worry about constantly keeping things up to date or attackers because in the end, it's all static HTML, which has other advantages as well. Steve, I'm not much of a Vivaldi user, but it's kind of a daily driver for you.
Yep. I use Vivaldi on the daily as my work browser. So I use Firefox as my private one, like my personal browser, and Vivaldi as my work one. And I know you can use profiles and stuff like that to keep things separate. I just prefer separate browsers. It helps my mental space. So for at least 5 years, I've been using Vivaldi, maybe longer. It's based on the old Opera browser, or at least it's has roots in the Opera browser. And there's a bunch of stuff that I like about it. Largely, the biggest thing was it's not Chrome, even though it tends to have the good compatibility with Chrome, including using the Chrome plugins. The downside to Vivaldi is that it is closed source, so it's not like it's not Firefox or Chromium. It is you know, a proprietary piece of work, and so there is that. But it can be keyboard driven, and that's really nice. I used that for a while. I haven't recently used that. I kind of fell out of it fell out of favor for me for one reason or another. I just kind of lost the habit. But if you learn the key bindings, it's really good. I like the way that it deals with tabs. So one of the things that I've done is we might have multiple tabs for various chats for various clients, and you can drag the tabs on top of each other, and it creates one tab that then has nested tabs in it. So if I get a notification, I have one blinking tab instead of 50. I find that particularly useful. And one of the other things that it's a small thing, but you can actually grab the address bar and drag it down. And if you do that, it will show you like a live thumbnail of what's happening on each website. And so, yeah, I've been quite happy with Vivaldi, keeping in mind that I specifically segment it to work-related things.
Anton writes in and says, "Hi, Noah and Steve. I'm a longtime listener, first time writing into the show. I have a question regarding databases. I'm setting up a single person, myself, medical practice, and I need advice on software. Through my limited searches, I found numerous amounts of software from big companies, but I'm looking for a more bespoke solution, and also something that will stand out the test of time as software companies come and go. I'm thinking about setting up my own database that I can use with the likes of accounting billing software such as Invoice Ninja, Microsoft Word to auto-populate the address in letters, and other software at the front end to insert data into the database. Along those lines, what type of database would you advise to use? My searches lead me to believe that MySQL would be a good choice. Specifically, my requirements are reliability and good long-term development, easy to interface with other software, ability to generate backups on a regular basis, secure built-in security and storing confidential data, and accessible from a LAN or multiple devices. Many thanks for the advice that you guys give and the suggestions. I really enjoy the show and the discussions that you guys have here. Keep up the good work." So, Steve, if you had somebody coming to you and saying, "Listen, I'm just looking for a very basic, very customizable database, I guess, framework," what would you suggest?
I probably would try and argue them out of it, just because it's a lot of headache, especially something that you build on your business on, right? So you could do it successfully. It's possible. It's not that the work itself is particularly hard, but if you are cobbling together pieces, and I don't mean cobbling derogatorily, I just mean if you are literally coupling together and adding the glue yourself to various pieces and something doesn't work, you're on the hook for it. And that can be pretty detrimental. I understand the idea of trying to want to avoid like vendor lock-in or being stuck with a specific vendor or even proprietary format. I get that. On the counter side, when you're thinking about businesses, you think, okay, what's the most expensive software that I might pay in this area? And if you say, okay, it's $1,000. Well, unless you are a tinkerer by nature and you want to do this for fun, I would say that it will take you quite a bit of time to cobble together something that you find satisfactory enough to do your business on. And that is where I would fall down on saying, well, you know what? If you're really running a business on this and it's not for yourself, you might be better off to just spend the money and get the license, provided that you do the shopping around to make sure that you can export your data.
So I would start here. I would second what Steve said. I really completely acknowledge the desire to stay out of vendor lock-in, and I don't think Steve or I would direct you towards any sort of proprietary solution. However, I think there are open source solutions that will achieve all of your goals, but save on the headaches. So reliable and good long-term support. Really what you're looking for there is a team that is developing the software for you, pushing fixes and updates so that you don't have to. You're rather unlikely to get that by rolling something yourself. Is it possible to do with something like Django? Yeah, it is. And in fact, I'm right in the middle of a project right now doing something like that. And so that is possible. But it's not the most efficient way to your ends. Ability to generate backups on a regular basis. Basically, every database software is going to have some way to do a Postgres dump or a database dump. Secure built-in security storing confidential information. This gets a little bit more challenging. And then accessible LAN on multiple devices and VMs. So now we need some sort of front end to expose the interface to. If it's a medical practice, one thing you might consider is something like OpenEMR. OpenEMR is designed completely open source top to bottom, so nobody's locking you into anything. It is, in fact, built on MySQL/Postgres on the back end, and so you are using an open source database to store stuff in there. But what they've done for you, they've designed a front-end UI that's all PHP largely, so it's, again, very open, accessible, customizable. They give you what they call a layout-based form editor, so you can create your own forms on what information you'd like to collect, which kind of checks the box for you on being a bespoke solution. However, where I think it's going to catapult you far ahead of rolling your own solution, in the medical world, it's really based off of two things. It's based off of diagnostic codes or CPT codes and procedure codes or ICD-10 codes. Those codes are what insurance companies want to see, and if you're taking Medicare or Medicaid, they require them. And so, well, actually, insurance companies do too, because you're going to have to go through a clearinghouse and they're going to want CPT and ICD-10 codes. So you're going to have to do that anyway. Not only do they build all of that in, they build all of that in and then they update the ICD-10 codes for you each year when new ones come out. And so you don't have to do any of that work. You literally just pull down the latest definitions for ICD-10, and Bob's your uncle and it's all there. So I would start with that. Put it up on a pedestal and see if it solves your needs. If it doesn't, well, maybe then start looking for a more bespoke solution. But if you can get what you need out of this, first of all, it doesn't cost you anything. So there's not even a $1,000 fee. You just go download it and set it up. If you didn't want to do that or didn't have the technical expertise, you could hire a company like AltaSpeed that would do a hosted instance for you and just provide it to you as a monthly fee. But the code is available to you, so nobody can lock you into it. If you want to take it with you, you certainly can. And if the project ever went under, and it's been around for quite some time, and it's the Brady, forget his last name, who runs it, is an oncologist in the United States and uses it in his practice. And we have a number of clients that are using it in their practice, so it's unlikely to go anywhere. The community that uses it are all people that contribute to the project. So you might consider just jumping on that board. And then if it doesn't meet your goals, then look at something else.
From the Linux Newswire newsroom, this is the Week in Review with JT.
For the week of March 24th, 2024, here's the Linux and open source news. The OSI has announced the results of its 2024 elections for the OSI Board of Directors. Red Hat announces Nova, a new NVIDIA driver written in Rust. Linus Torvalds has announced the first Linux kernel 6.9 release candidate. The gaming-focused Linux distro Regatta OS 24, codenamed Arctic Fox, has launched with Plasma 6. Wine 9.5 is out. Kafka UI, the open-source web UI for managing Apache Kafka clusters, has released version 1.0. Mozilla Firefox 124 is now available. The GNOME team has announced version 45.5, as well as 46 is now available. GNU Emacs 29.3 has been released. CMake 3.29 is out. OpenVPN 2.6.10 has been released. SysVN 3.09 is out. And Docker 26 has been announced. In hardware news, System76 has unveiled a new Lemur Pro Linux laptop with up to 56 gigabytes of RAM. In AI news, Devika is a new agentic AI software engineer that aims to be an open source alternative to Devin by Cognition AI. And lastly, the Ubuntu LTS releases can now get 12 years of updates. The new legacy support program will help specialized systems stay secure for over a decade.
Shufflecake. You might remember TrueCrypt and Veracrypt, and you might remember, at least with TrueCrypt, some of the negative press that followed as it became compromised. Well, Shufflecake is a tool for Linux that allows you to create multiple hidden volumes on a storage device in such a way that it's difficult, even impossible, for forensic inspection to prove the existence of such volumes. So this can be really useful for people whose freedom of expression is threatened by repressive authorities or in dangerous criminal organizations, in particular whistleblowers, investigative journalists, human rights activists, those kinds of people that need to take their operational security to the next level. ShuffleCake could be considered a spiritual successor to things like TrueCrypt and VeraCrypt. So I wanted to bring some attention to it on the show. It works natively on Linux. It supports any file system that you want. You can manage nested volumes per device. You can make it so that there's a deniability of even the existence of those partitions. Essentially, in ShuffleCake, each hidden volume is encrypted with a different secret key and then scrambled across the empty space of an underlying existing storage medium. And so it's indistinguishable from other random noise when it's not decrypted. And so even if the presence of ShuffleCake software itself can't be hidden, and hence the presence of the secret volume is that somebody suspects that it's there, the number of volumes is also hidden. And that allows a user to create a hierarchy of plausible deniability where the most hidden secrets are buried under less hidden secrets, or what you might call decoy volumes, whose passwords can be surrendered under pressure. And so somebody has you and they, you know, this conversation I watch play out over and over and over on the internet. Is this really secure? Could this really stop a state-sponsored attack? And the answer to that question is typically yes, under proper circumstances, the technology will withstand brute force, that sort of thing. You know what it doesn't withstand? A crowbar, a bamboo shoots. I mean, those kinds of things are, you know, they'll beat the password out of you, for lack of a better way to put it. And so what ShuffleCake does is it allows you to have decoyed volumes that you can give up the password, and then all of a sudden says, oh, okay, now I can see what's under here. I can see, I think I've gotten access to their data. In truth, they don't, because they don't know that there's another underlying volume. So ShuffleCake, you can learn more at shufflecake.net. Highly recommend you check it out. They're on Mastodon, they're on XMPP, and the whole system is super fast. Minor slowdown with I/O throughput compared to just a bare Lux encrypted system, but negligible waste of memory and disk space. And the entire project is free and open source. The source code is available. You can find it under the install section. It's licensed as GPL 2.0. Steve, I think I know the answer to this question, but do you have any need or an interest in hidden encrypted partitions, or not so much?
Not really the hidden stuff. I still do the old-fashioned GPG encryption, and I also have full disk encryption on my laptop. So anything that's likely to walk with me will, the disks are encrypted anyways. So I could see having a use case for it maybe, but I also don't keep, so the stuff that I GPG encrypt also comes off of any of the actual computers and goes and lives on a ZFS data set. So I pull it down, I decrypt it, I do whatever I need to, I get rid of it. So it's just not hanging around on any of the systems I'm using actively.
Very good. So if you have a need for a hidden partition, I highly recommend you check it out. You can learn more again, shufflecake.net. I'm happy to see that there's a progression of the TrueCrypt VeraCrypt system. I think that's really cool. I think it's even particularly awesome that it's natively available on Linux. Hey, the music in our ears, you know what it means. It means we're out of time for this week, but the show airs every week at Tuesday at 6 p.m. Central. If you join us live, you can ask your question or join the discussion. We'd love to have you. If you can't join us live, well, don't worry. The entire back catalog is available at podcast.asknoahshow.com. There you'll find not just the back catalog of episodes, but you'll find the show notes. What's in the show notes? Well, all of the things that we didn't have time to get to. We still publish them in the show notes, so you can find references to all the articles that we reference. We're back next Tuesday, 6 p.m. Central, asknoahshow.com.